have shown that the farm soil we get our vegetables from is dead, meaning it is depleted of minerals. Sulfur is a mineral. Sulfur has been depleted from the soil, which means most people have been depleted of sulfur. Sulfur has been found to transport oxygen throughout the body. You need oxygen. You need organic sulfur. American Voice Radio Network has organic sulfur. Go to AmericanVoiceRadio.com and then to the Superstore to order your organic sulfur. It's your choice. Do you want to feel better or not? Don't forget to tune in to the Sulfur Hour Plus One on AmericanVoiceRadio.com Thursdays, 6 p.m. Pacific. Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be joining you immediately following the first commercial break of the program today. But first, let's get started with the market reports for Thursday, July 7th, 2016. And we have a little bit of pressure on gold today. We have it down 360. 360 for gold, not so bad. At 1360, a little pressure on silver down 40 at 1976. But we did see positive territory for both platinum and palladium. Platinum was up 5 at 1094. Palladium was up 3 at 613. The USDX today was up a little bit, 0.19 at 96.26. Crude oil was down a little, about almost 4%. Down 2.32 at 45.11. And the paper markets today, you had the Dow was down 22 points at 17,895. The NASDAQ was up 17 at 48.76, and S&P was down 1 point basically to 2,097. Not a lot of change in the paper markets there today. The 10-year yield still holding 139. The euro is still at 111. Both Germany and London were up, but there was still heavy pressure on Hong Kong and, of course, Japan. I was a little late in getting started today, so I guess there was an interesting time in Washington today. Both the House and Senate Republicans, they came face-to-face for the first time with Mr. Donald J. Trump. His daughter, Ivanka, and Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus was also in attendance. Trump met with the full House GOP conference at RNC headquarters. Their gathering pretty much came as rank and file Republicans. I guess they're trying to rally behind Mr. Trump before the convention this month. You know, the only thing that, you know, there's so many good things about Donald Trump. And then there's just those few things that just irritate the heck out of me. And there was at least 200 lawmakers that were attending. Larry Kudlow, CNBC commentator, introduced Donald. And I'm not a fan of Larry Kudlow. And yet I know he is quite a influence when it comes to economics for Donald Trump. So not a fan of Larry Kudlow. I guess he's better than some, but you know, he's a Wall Streeter. He likes that strong dollar, and I just don't think he gets it also. You know, he's more of a globalist and conservative, but that doesn't mean you know, for our economy that he'd be the best one. Although I'd have to agree, Larry Kudlow would be behind in cutting a lot of the regulations for small businesses and so forth, but I'm not a fan of Larry Kudlow. See, anything he promised, Trump promised tax reform, protecting the Second Amendment, repealing Obamacare, and of course that he would be... he would stick by his list of potentials for the Supreme Court, and naturally he had to bash both Hillary and Bill Clinton, and of course they are therefore, they're certainly very bashable, as I believe they're probably the most evil, not the most evil people on the planet, but fairly close, fairly close. You know, it was really interesting. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, he says, anytime you have the vast majority of the Republican state conference come to a meeting early and stay late, it's a good meeting. It's like, yeah, you lazy bums. You know, you're always out, you know, signing things quick before vacation. You can't miss a holiday. I mean, it's just like, it's just the typical worker anymore, you know, who sacrifices anything anymore. And, you know, hey, I don't want to be there early, and I'm certainly not going to stay there late. But these are, I mean, it's just, it truly is pathetic and sad, very sad, disturbing. So that was pretty much for Trump. Didn't hear much from the Federal Reserve yesterday as the minutes of its June meeting were published. You know, the June statement suggests the monetary policies were divided into two camps. There were six that were believing it would be appropriate to raise rates only once this year. There were nine who expect two rate increases in the event that their economic forecasts were realized. Well, good luck with that. And it's kind of scary to think that these are the people that are in charge of our monetary policy. And that alone should also scare you into gold and silver. So, you know, and it's the same old, what I used to use as a little child, gobbledygook, as far as coming from the Federal Reserve, from Janet Yellen. You know, that depends on what the non-paid foreign payrolls are, the Brexit is a concern, inflation is a concern, And it's the same old BS. They're not going to be raising rates until 2019, if they can do it then. So, you know, they're not going to raise rates until something very nasty will happen. I mean, it will be the purging of the system and everything else before they're able to raise rates again. And I can't even imagine what the June non-farm payroll report's going to be. I would expect May to be revised up from the 38,000. I mean, you have Clinton and Obama circulating the planet in Air Force One in celebration of her recent victory. I would think that the June report should be a worthy number to support their joyous momentum as they travel the globe, or at least travel the states in Air Force One. Unless they hold off with better numbers, with a little bit better line as we get closer to the election, we're going to find out tomorrow. I don't think it's going to be just a you know, 38,000 was last month. Yeah, they're going to revise that. I don't think it's going to be a surprise number, but I think it's going to be a number that we're going to say, "Are you kidding me?" You know, "Are you kidding me?" So we'll have to wait and see. The markets are kind of telling us that it's not going to be as good a number as everyone anticipates. I've seen numbers from 169,000, 150,000. I think ADP was 169 or somewhere in that area. So we'll have to wait and see. But it would affect the markets a little bit tomorrow. So we could have a little more. If the numbers are really, really good, you know, we might have a knee-jerk reaction in the gold market, you know, thinking, oh, you know. But I think the gold market will come to its senses and say, well, that's a big old fat lie. You know, and then, you know, we could possibly see a reversal. If not tomorrow, then we'll probably see it next week. But you can never, ever underestimate these people, the power that they have and their ability to do things that leaves us scratching our heads thinking, well, gee, I didn't expect that. So, you know, and that's why I always stick to the fundamentals of the gold and silver. I stick to the fundamentals of the markets because those do not lie to you. And that is what they're not as exciting, maybe. You know, they're not, you know, the fundamentals don't make you feel good. Some might. I mean, the fundamentals of gold going to, I believe, 5,000 and higher should make you feel great. But I can't promise you that. There was another article by Wall Street Journal, the big bank bloodbath, losses near $500 billion. 20 of the big banks, their share prices are plunging this year. They've erased a quarter of their combined market value. Valuations show investors aren't feeling so confident. And how often do you hear both Al and myself talking about confidence? The whole world is based on confidence. You have UniCredit, trades at about 21% of book value, a measure of a bank's net worth. Deutsche Bank trades at about 26%. Or at the same exact place where it was during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. There's only one that was trading at a premium, and that was Wells Fargo. And I'll expect that to change once they continue to put on those subprime mortgage loans that with 3% down that we talked about on this program that I told you about. And, you know, then they're selling the book to Fannie Mae. Might not show it now, but it will. It'll catch up to them. You know, with the plunging bond yields around the globe, this is even exacerbated the concern by these banks' profit margins. And I don't think we're going to see any changes to yields anytime soon. Just the fact that the banks are trading at less than half their book value should flag concern. Deutsche Bank, I mean, they're in big trouble. I mean, here's this Germany's national, you know, their big banking champion, still a big player on Wall Street, now has a market value that in dollar terms is less than that of SunTrust Bank, a regional U.S. bank that's just focused in the Southeast. So, again, this tiny little bank in the you know, Southeast, I thought they were in the Southwest, but in the South, has a stronger market value greater than the Deutsche Bank. But I guarantee you the tiny bank isn't carrying as many derivatives on the books like Deutsche Bank is. And speaking of derivatives, Italian Prime Minister Renzi said Italians' bad loan woes are tiny compared to Europe's derivative problem. He says the difficulties facing Italian banks, and we've talked about this week, I mean, they're down 30, 40, 50% over their bad loans, are minuscule by comparison with the problems some European banks face over their derivatives. This is what the Italian Prime Minister said yesterday. Italian bank shares have tumbled in recent days and are on the worst performers among European lenders this year on investors' concern on how they handle some 360 billion euros of bad and non-performing loans. Speaking at a joint news conference with Swedish Prime Minister Löfven, Renzi said other European banks had much bigger problems than their Italian counterparts. If this non-performing loan problem is worth one, the question of derivatives at other banks, at big banks, Deutsche Bank maybe, is worth 100. This is the ratio, he said, 1 to 100. And hey, he knows it's going to get much worse, and he knows he's going to get a lot of blame of what's going on in Italy when it collapses. He's just not going to be the only one going down with the ship. And he's going to expose the rest of them. And good for him. I mean, good for him. And so he's warning everyone, hey, it's just not my banks here in Italy. It's the big banks and their derivatives that are going to be the problems. Before we recap, I got another 2 minutes. I just want to remind you, we got some great prices on our gold and silver. $20 gold pieces are just a steal. They're still a steal at this point in time. We might see a little pressure on gold. I saw where the electronic trading had raised margins on gold. I mean, if you hold your physical gold, that doesn't really apply to you. You'll be thankful that you're holding your physical gold. On the other hand, you know, I could put a little, it could put a little pressure on the price for a little bit, but I think it'll be short-lived. Maybe we saw that today, and it was only down a few bucks. So, you know, no big change there, but it was worth mentioning. And I had mentioned yesterday the hedge funds, mostly real estate, commercial properties in England, are freezing accounts due to the Brexit aftershock. And their currency dropping to these 35-year lows. I had mentioned a total of five, but there are actually seven funds that have been frozen this week. More than $32 billion in U.S. dollars that are held in investment products of this type. It's now under lock and key. And the funny thing about it, there was one firm, Aberdeen Fund Managers, slashed their value of its fund by 17%. They temporarily halted withdrawals so investors would have a chance to, reconsider to pull their money out. Perhaps they'll change their mind. Maybe they won't pull their money out. And this is what they do if they think, and that's what's going to happen to you. You're going to want to withdraw. These funds will be closed. You won't have a chance to pull your money out. And they're hoping to, stem the market losses for a brief period of time for you to reconsider. And these are the games that they're going to be playing with you. They played them here before, and they're going to play them again, but only to a larger degree. And I'm right here going into our break time. A few commercials will be here, and Alfred and James Corbett will be here for the next two segments. 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call. We got some great prices on all our gold and silver coins.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves?
Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663, or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, which is an extraordinary and fantastic collection of articles, podcasts, videos. I'm not sure. There are probably messages in bottles. I'm not sure. James, have you put out any messages in bottles?
Not yet, but actually that's not a bad idea. Maybe I'll try that.
I understand. You may be able to do something with balloons or something. Who knows? Drones. We may be able to put out a drone with a message in it. 2 weeks ago, you predicted that the Brexit movement vote would, by hook or by crook, be defeated. 1 week ago, I teased you about your mistaken prediction. However, since the Brexit vote won in Great Britain, we continue to see predictions that despite that victory, one way or another, Great Britain will remain part of the European Union. For example, here's an article from the AFP entitled, Britain Will Remain in the EU, Austrian Minister. Britain will not quit the European Union despite voting to do so, according to Austria's finance minister, Hans Schelling. In 5 years, there will still be 28 member states. That's his prediction. He also said that the United Kingdom might break up, with Scotland and Northern Ireland voting to distance itself from Great Britain. So my question to you is, do you think that the Brexit movement is a done deal? Is it irreversible? Or is there a good or even high probability that Britain will ultimately remain in the European Union?
Well, to borrow a favorite political doublespeak phrase from the American political crap class, all options are on the table. And really and truly, any one of those situations could play out. We could see the UK remain in the EU. We could see some type of negotiated exit, which is just an exit in name, but actually formally maintains a lot of the relationship with the EU. We could see the UK disintegrating and various pieces of the former remains of the disunited kingdom joining back up with the EU. There's truly nothing that's off the table at this point. Even a second referendum has certainly been floated, although no one has in the political class has given it much credence yet. But again, there's many different ways this can play out. And I think anyone who says definitively which way this is going to play out is either lying or maybe in on the plot.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit. Let me shift down here to Russia. I'm scrolling through my scrolling. Here's a comment from Russia, and this is reported. We Are Change, and the headline is Russia Brexit EU fall. Brexit EU fallout looks like collapse of the Soviet Union. And Russia's warned that while it's unreasonable to draw direct parallels, it's obvious that the UK is going through a turbulent, confusing, and unpredictable period. I wonder if they meant the UK or they meant the European Union, but they said UK. This is from Russian Finance Minister Anton Siluanov. Russia is right, as already 8 countries, France, Holland, Italy, Austria, Finland, Hungary, Portugal, and Slovakia, have expressed the want to follow Britain's lead and leave and have a referendum. There is a Brexit domino effect. So I'm wondering, is the comparison between Brexit and the fall of the Soviet Union, is that reasonable or exaggerated?
You know, actually, I haven't heard that comparison yet, although that is an intriguing one, isn't it? Because, of course, with the fall of the Soviet Union, we saw the periphery of the Soviet Union falling apart first, and then ultimately, you know, Ukraine and other parts of that union declaring their own type of independence, and ultimately it all just ended quite quickly after that point. So I suppose there could be, I mean, again, it depends on which way this all plays out, but there could be some analogies there. Obviously, I wouldn't push that analogy too far. But I think from a Russian perspective, what is happening in the European Union is obviously of great interest and could work to Russia's benefit, or really to the benefit of people around the world who are interested in seeing peace rather than war, if it means that this is a breakup of the pact that holds Eastern Europe in the sway of Western Europe, which is to say having all of these periphery states that are really on Russia's doorstep welded together with a bureaucracy in Brussels, where their natural alliances and probably economic best interests would be served by being more open, at the very least, to trade with Russia. So there is a chance that this could pull apart in such a way that we might see a little bit more stability, a little bit more overtures towards peace and détente, rather than this ratcheting up of tensions. However, in the short term, at least, this is having the exact opposite effect. And we just saw, just earlier on last Friday, this coming from Reuters, NATO leaders meet in Warsaw, next Friday, to cement a new deterrent against what they see as an emboldened Russia returning to Cold War-style defense, with Washington again taking the part of Europe's protector. So we see NATO, in fact, rallying even closer together as a reaction to the potential instability that's happening right now in the European Union, which is only going to increase tensions with Russia. And that is obviously the wrong direction. So again, like the Brexit and the future of the European Union itself, this could go either way. And we could see either a period where Eastern Europe starts to move closer into the Russian sphere, or we could see the exact opposite and NATO tighten its grip even further.
Is NATO warning about Russia because Russia poses a real threat to Europe? Or are they basically creating a boogeyman to justify and try to terrify the nations of the European Union to stay in the Union because, oh my gosh, if we don't, you know what's going to happen? The Russians are going to invade.
There is no non-propagandistic narrative that in any way can be used to paint the idea that Russia is a violent aggressor and has some sort of poses some sort of existential threat to the countries of Eastern Europe. I think that a lot of that is rhetoric and blather. To be fair, on the other side, in the alternative media in the West, you'll see a lot of unquestioning praise of Putin in Russia as if it's some sort of spotless, wonderful, you know, shining beacon of freedom and virtue in the world. I think that's ridiculous as well. But clearly, I do not see any indication that Russia is being militarily aggressive in its actions and responding to the Ukraine crisis by accepting I want to say Cyprus. It's not Cyprus. Odessa? No. Accepting that small piece of the Ukraine back into the Russian Federation is, it was not militarily aggressive or anything else that it's been portrayed as by the neocons.
Yeah, it was dumped in its lap, essentially.
Exactly.
It's,
I mean,
like
I don't think
that was... It's like finding a baby on the doorstep, and now you've got to feed it.
So I think we have to see Russia playing defense against what is an increasingly aggressive NATO. And again, we don't even have to speculate about that. We recently had some recent emails from the former NATO general Breedlove, who was the former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, who on this website, dcleaks.com, released a bunch of his private emails that he was sending around to a number of people in the American, the NATO, and European political establishment to try to basically find ways to lobby the Obama government, Obama administration, Obama himself, for the idea of we need more money, we need more thought, we need more troops being committed to this Russian threat. So they have, NATO has been 100% undeniably ramping up towards this Russian front that they're opening right now. And I still continue to think that the long-term game plan here is not an actual hot, outright military war, but I do think they certainly want to contain Russia as tightly as possible, economically as well as geographically. And I think they also want, of course, to ramp up to Cold War levels of military expenditure. And of course, there are the usual interests that benefit from that.
Again, do you think the forces in NATO that are warning about Russians, are they legitimately warning about Russia, or is this just being used as a device to say, oh my gosh, the boogeyman's out there and we better all stay united and get one military system put together here to defend ourselves? Propaganda mostly, or legitimate warning mostly?
If there is anything other than propaganda in these statements, I have yet mm-hmm. to see it. I can't find any statement of what specifically it is that they feel is new on the table with Russia, with regards to Russia. That Reuters article I was talking about before quotes Douglas Lute, the envoy from the U.S. to NATO, as saying, we're in a new relationship with a newly aggressive, newly assertive Russia. It's brought us back to the primacy of our initial core task, collective defense, our immediate neighborhood. Again, that is just rhetoric. It's just blather. There is no substance to saying, I mean, you can state that this is a newly aggressive, newly assertive Russia, but what is the evidence for that? And I have never seen that presented in a cogent, coherent, persuasive manner by anyone on that side of the debate. So I have to say that it is propaganda at this point. And I don't know. Maybe there are people in the Washington Beltway who actually truly believe this. But it seems to me a very deliberate attempt to whip up a boogeyman so that we can basically spend money on trying to keep it contained.
You know, as we're speaking, it crosses my mind that Vladimir Putin has an image in the media of being a strong man. We see pictures of him riding a horse without a shirt. We see him firing a rifle. I mean, he goes through this. He's got a very masculine appearance, and he looks like the sort of guy who would be inclined to go to war, if you catch my drift. Do you suppose his image plays, and I don't know if the image is this an image that he wants to foster, or is this an image that's being foisted off upon him in order to prove that he's a natural warmonger?
Right. I see what you're saying. I think clearly, like every political persona, it is a carefully crafted PR persona. And I think he's playing to his base in the Russian polity in the electorate there in Russia, which sees that as, you know, the strong leader that we need in these turbulent times or whatever. And it plays very well with that base, which is the core constituency of his, voting public. At the same time, it plays, as you say, it plays very well into the boogeyman image that in the West. We want to, the photo opportunities that show that this is a, you know, kind of a crazy, dangerous, militaristic man with no human emotion kind of thing. And his PR personality plays into that. I mean, all these photo ops don't just happen. It's not like there's just randomly some cameraman who snaps this. Mm-hmm. All of this, of course, is planned in advance. And he takes the big camera crews out, you know, when he goes to the zoo or whatever to go shoot a tranquilizer dart into a tiger or things of that nature. That doesn't happen by accident. That is clearly a planned stage photo opportunity. So it's clearly something that he wants, and I think, again, that's for internal domestic purposes, but it does play a role in the creation of this image on the international scale as well. And it's best to keep in mind that all of these personas are, of course, personas, and they do not necessarily reflect the real workings of government, which, of course, generally happen at the deep state level rather than the sort of surface level that we see when presidents go for photo opportunities.
If these personas, and they have multiple personas for all of these people, but if these, all of these politicians and leaders, if these personas do not reflect the reality of the individual, can we say that the personas reflect the susceptibility of the public? Are we sending out personas that reflect what this guy really is, or are we sending out personas that the public really wants to see? Sometimes they want to see him as a hero. Sometimes they want to see him as a boogeyman. But does the persona reflect the public, or does it reflect the reality of the individual?
I think there's an interplay with those things. And I think I have no doubt that if you really closely followed Putin and all of the various photo opportunities and staged events and things that happen in public, I'm sure there are many that do not play into that particular persona. But those ones, the shirtless horse riding or the karate or weightlifting with the president and things like that, those clearly do play into that image, and therefore they get spread more widely. People are more interested in that. So I think there is a sense to which the public is the curator of these personas, in that they choose, to a certain extent, it's public interest that drives what ultimately gets presented and what doesn't. But there's also the interplay where the public interest is to some extent managed and determined by the propaganda narratives that are delivered through the media. So I think it plays both ways.
Well, it always does, I guess. It's one of those things, but it's intriguing, just to me at least, to sit back and say, what is this? Does this persona really tell us about the man, or does it tell us about some vulnerability, some susceptibility in the public? This is what they want to see. We're going to show them what they want to see, and then they'll follow us, and they'll give us more money because, you know, it's like wagging the dog. You know, it becomes increasingly, we see evidence. It's not just a movie. It's not just a fiction. And I assume you're familiar with the movie Wagging the Dog.
Oh, I certainly am, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's the Hollywood comes out and creates an image in order, makes things apparently happen that didn't really happen, but the public wants to see it, so it works. Trying to draw that line between reality and appearance isn't easily done.
No, good luck.
Yeah, I know. Good luck with that. I mean, and then you get into a question, and we have 30 seconds left. When we have to talk about reality, we're looking at, for example, just Vladimir Putin. Right? There's his reality. We say that's reality. But what about the public opinion? Is that reality, or is that just some sort of a fiction?
It's a type of self-fulfilling reality or self-creating reality. And I think that's even more important as we go ahead into the new sort of political era that we're moving into. And perhaps we can talk about that a little bit more after the break.
All right. We're going to take a break for couple of commercials. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
about thyme herb provided strength. Indeed, the chemical compounds of thyme contain antioxidants, an effective germicide that kills whooping cough bacteria and makes breathing easier. Just imagine what you can do with thyme herb when it comes to respiratory ailments like croup, pneumonia, asthma, and sinusitis. The extra benefit of thyme herb is that it soothes nerves and stops spasmodic coughing, so you can get some rest. Who says you don't have time to take care of yourself? Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free for thyme tincture and tea to soothe your cough and get some rest. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International 704-875-8010 or online at thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We were talking about the difference between appearances and realities and wondering, you know, is appearance reality? That was part of it, I guess. Did you have something you wanted to go into on that subject or along those lines?
I did, if you wanted to follow me. I think it is important for the political era that we're moving into online, where so much is now taking place online and public perception is being both reflected and created there. And I think that's important to keep in mind because there is a documented phenomenon that has, I just off the top of my head, I have seen with respect to the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the Israeli government, the Russian government, the Chinese government, and presumably probably every government around the world, but those are the stories that I've seen over the last couple of years that come to mind, where these governments are actually paying people, either military or in just as some sort of subset of the government, to go and leave comments online that are in support of official government narratives or against anti-government media of various sorts. Why on earth would governments be paying people to basically sit online and leave comments all day? It is because there has actually been scientific research on this now that does confirm this. People's perceptions of stories are influenced by the comment section. Comments can change people's perception of what that story is or what's important about it. And more and more, that this is becoming more and more understood and more of a reflected reality as we move forward in the internet era. This is why so many of the major blogs and major sites have closed down their comment section altogether. Scientific American did this a couple of years ago, but and a lot of science journals and science websites have done this because, you know, these crazy anti-science Luddites are getting into the comment section and, you know, messing up their narratives, I guess. But this, so then when we look at it in the context of what we were talking about earlier with is appearance reality, I think we're moving into a political era where it is perfectly conceivable to imagine a sort of grassroots, quote unquote, movement arising out of this type of manipulated reality where paid government workers are leaving comments and trying to create the perception of a movement of some sort that in turn actually does end up creating a genuine movement of sorts as more people actually sort of naturally adopt those attitudes. I think that is absolutely something that we could see happening if it isn't already happening. And I do have my questions about various political movements at the moment, including the Trump phenomenon and things that are going on there. I think that might be a perfect example of a phenomenon that was purchased at first and has become an authentic movement. And we can go back to Trump's initial announcement of his presidential candidacy, where people showed up wearing Trump 2016 t-shirts and baseball caps and holding signs, and at the very beginning of his presidency. And it turned out, as when people started to look into this and they found the actual social media of some of the people there, these are literally paid actors who were paid to be there and wear signs. This isn't surprising. We've seen this in all sorts of different presidential campaigns. But I just think it's interesting to think of the ways that a fake movement can be created that then ends up becoming a real movement because people are so influenced by what they're seeing and reading online.
Are people so influenced because the internet and the online comments are so powerful? Or are they influenced because they don't have any more long-term values? Part of the idea behind being subject, the appearance becoming reality, the appearance can change on a day-by-day, hour-by-hour basis. We see things on Yahoo trending now. Here's what's hot right now. And it doesn't, and it can be powerfully hot, go viral. And yet, 10 days from now, it can be just ancient history. And the point is, what is the reality when the reality can change on a momentary basis?
The reality in that sense is reflecting, is a consensus reality that is created by the nature of humans who, I will say, are social. I won't say social animals in deference to your what you've pointed out about that term being used for humans. Mm-hmm. But humans are essentially social beings, and we take our cues from social phenomena. And that's, I think that's healthy and good when we're talking in the sense of communities and interacting with people in real life. But now that we're moving online, I think we're still wired to be social in that sense. But now we're picking up cues from things we're reading on the screen from people who may or may not be employed by governments, but we don't know. I think that still, we still have the same reaction to that as we would if we went out into, the cafe in town and we're sitting around talking to a bunch of people there. And there was kind of, that kind of town square-ish feel where everyone's talking about the same thing or reflecting the same ideas. That will start to influence the way you think. In the same way, when you start to see these comments popping up everywhere online along the same vein, it will start to influence what you think. The other aspect of that is that also people like winners. I mean, this is one of the big themes of the Trump campaign. We're going to win. We're going to win so much you'll be sick of winning by the time we're done winning. And it's the phenomenon that feeds on itself. Everyone wants to be on the winning team. Everyone wants to jump on the bandwagon when it's going good. And that creates that snowball effect. So we can see things being movements again being created or embiggened, to use a Simpsons phrase, by the very fact that it is growing. It is the Trump train, as they call it. We can look at this in a different phenomenon.
It's like an imaginary train, and it looks big and powerful and the rest of that, and yet it can be old news. If we have government people out there trying to control public opinion by planting certain ideas and articles and whatever on the internet, aren't they a little bit discouraged? I mean, they can create an image, they can create an opinion where we all believe that there's little green men landing here, coming here from the moon. In theory, they could get that done. But also, it's only going to stick around for how long? A few days, weeks, or months? And then a new appearance, and then there's going to be a new apparent reality. Everybody says, oh, no, it's not green men. It's purple, whatever. It's purple women coming from Mars. I mean, there's got to be something frustrating. They have to be looking for a way to permanently change, or maybe not permanently, but for a long-term change in the public psyche. And are they able to achieve that, or does it just come and go so fast? It's like rolling dice in a casino in Las Vegas.
From the perspective of a social engineer, someone who wants to be able to program into the public any belief that they want at any time, there is nothing better than having a rootless public that will jump on any bandwagon that comes along, because then you can create any reality you want at any time. And that is the explicit aim of, for example, there's the famous quote that a journalist whose name I'm not going to remember right now attributes to Karl Rove, who told him sort of off the record at an event in Washington back during the Bush era, we create reality, and you guys out there just write about what we're doing, but by the time you write about it, we create a new reality. And that is the perspective of, I think, the ruling power clique. And again, another place we could look for an example of that is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wrote Between Two Ages, the U.S. in the Technotronic Era, I believe is the subtitle, where he was writing that it is the aim, ultimately, they want to create a reality in which people are told at all times what to do and how to think about all manner of things, so that you can't even go outside, you know, on a day-to-day basis without hearing the weatherman tell you, okay, it's raining today, you better bring your umbrella. It can go to that level of kind of day-to-day mundane sort of things, but how much more powerful is that when they're talking about, you know, the ultimate running of the economy and war and all of these grand things? So I think there is definite interest in creating that or fostering or helping along that phenomenon that's developing online, where people do jump on bandwagons and people are essentially rootless and people can be convinced that the world is flat because they saw a YouTube video about it, you know, yesterday. And that really is happening. And I think it is documentably a part of what the social engineers have been lusting after for decades now.
Do you think these social engineers are approaching their work with great enthusiasm and excitement, or are they approaching it with a certain amount of fear? I mean, if they can create a reality today in the minds of most people, if they can, let's type this in here and it'll change people's minds and strange things are going to, and things are going to happen that are to our benefit, they have to recognize that somebody else can get on the internet and type something else, insert another article that will do something exactly contrary to what the social engineers want. If the public is so malleable that they'll believe anything at any moment, you can't count on their loyalty. Is that cause for the masters of the universe to, should they take, are they encouraged by that or are they frightened by it? These people are crazy.
Yeah, they are crazy.
If you deal with them long enough, you got to sit back and say these people are crazy.
Right. I mean, I think psychopathic might be, or so, at least sociopathic might be the better way
public.
To describe it.
I'm talking about the public.
Oh, right. Okay.
The right. But I'm saying if they have no system of values, we can't count on anything. We could wake up tomorrow and they have a completely different perspective that will overthrow the existing establishment.
Well, from the perspective of the social engineers, that's just an engineering problem. And it also is why, of course, they have explicitly and on the record and in various documents over the decades called for total information warfare, total information control, full spectrum dominance. The different words they throw around. They want to be able to completely control the narrative. They're not there yet. And I think one of the engineering problems is that, yes, you can try to start any type of meme or any idea, but not everyone is going to catch on. You could, I mean, do you not think the Hillary campaign is right now trying to get memes trending about, you know, how great Hillary is or whatever? You can't do that to a public that simply, I mean, is 100% against that. There has to be some kernel of reality within that. You can't just create completely out of
whole cloth. Well, again, this goes to the idea, I'm wondering if the social engineering is most effective when you find out what does the public want to hear, and we'll tell them that. Hillary's not necessarily telling the public what they want to hear. And if she's not telling them what they want to hear, her attempt at social engineering isn't dealing with the reality of the public sentiment. They don't want to hear that. They aren't going to buy it. And we are becoming sensitive to where we recognize when we're being conned by people in positions of power. We have a growing understanding of when we're dealing with propaganda and when we're dealing with the truth. Might not
Absolutely.
Be precise, but I think it's growing.
No, I agree. The most effective lies have to have a kernel of truth within them that people can resonate with, that people can understand, that people can see, that can be demonstrated, that people already believe. And from that, you try to build things in a different direction, which is why things like the Brexit vote or things like the Trump phenomenon are a genuine expression of the public getting sick and tired of the technocrats, the bureaucrats, the establishment system that exists and wanting to do something against it. And so from the perspective of the social engineer, the idea is, okay, this exists in the public. This feeling exists. how can we use that feeling? How can we get that momentum and turn it against the public? And that's the real question. It's always a question of, okay, let's press on that nerve and see if we can turn it into the opposite of what the people want. And they're surprisingly successful with that time and time again. Recent example in recent history, look at Egypt and the Arab Spring and all of that. Let's throw out that evil dictator and replace him with the same military oligarchy that was ruling before. It doesn't really change unless you really push it through to its conclusion, and it can be derailed so quickly.
I've got one last subject here to talk briefly, to mention briefly. Here's something from AFP, the French equivalent of the Associated Press. Kenyan lawmakers held for hate speech. 8 Kenyan politicians are behind bars on suspicion of hate speech in the latest sign of rising political tensions a year ahead of the elections in Kenya. Now, it just surprises me that the whole concept of hate speech, I understand it's floating around here in the United States, I understand it's in Europe, but it's even in Kenya. And this is an attempt to control what people say and think. And they're even doing it in Kenya. Is it happening in Japan? Is it happening in China? Are these the first steps of eliminating free speech?
Well, interestingly, there is actually a recent thing happening in Japan where they are trying to crack down on certain types of hate speech, free speech, whatever you want to call it, where people will drive around in these vans with loudspeakers blasting racial epithets at ethnic Koreans who live in Japan. And they're trying to find a way legally to stop that from happening without abrogating people's free speech rights in the Constitution. So that court battle is playing out. But I'm Canadian, and in Canada, there are hate speech laws. There are tribunals that can happen if someone says the wrong thing that is completely off the table politically, they can be prosecuted for it. And I think it's something that Americans maybe don't, it's like fish taking water for granted. Maybe Americans take the First Amendment for granted. It really is the strongest example of free speech laws, I think, that have ever existed in human history. And the norm is for governments to basically outlaw various types of speech that they don't like. So it has to be appreciated, to be understood, to be protected. And I think Americans should be very concerned, because I think we definitely see a growing part of the public that really would like to ban various types of free speech that they're not comfortable with.
I don't know if they do. Is a growing percentage of the we're out of time. We're going to have to let that go for another time. But the question, maybe we'll talk about it in the next is a growing number of people willing to suppress hate speech, or are they simply indifferent to the idea of suppressing free speech? And we'll have to leave that answer for another day. James, thank you for being on the program. Always a pleasure, always interesting. That's James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Visit when you have time, opportunity, and interest. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank the producer. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.